Welcome to Sanity, a podcast by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, along with my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, we try to make sense out of the nonsense and bring some sanity to your week. Check out our Sanity podcast coming on Sunday with Tiffany Justice of Moms for Liberty. You won't want to miss it.
And now the Heritage Foundation.
And the Heritage Foundation. Really wide-ranging conversation about schools and the Constitution and parents and children. I learned a lot, and I think you will too.
Great. Quote of the week time, and it comes from the Oscar Wilde of our day, Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, whose accent I'm not going to try to imitate, but it's really good. He said this week, "I trust Qatar like I trust a rest stop bathroom. If they want to be friendly, I want to be friendly back. But with those guys, trust in God, but tie up your camel."
There's so many mixed metaphors there. It's just fantastic.
The Southern drawl, it's even better. But right. I mean, it just couldn't be a better way to set up our first segment.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah,
was
it great. Could be our quote of the week every week.
Yeah, you'd never think that John Kennedy was a Rhodes Scholar and has this gilded resume.
Only
but
somebody
he's a true American
could be
original.
That funny, actually.
Totally, totally. And we might come back to the Air Force Qatar later.
But. Okay. So our top story this week is the Middle East trip that President Trump took. And we could talk the entire podcast just about this trip because it was just so filled. It's still going on. The president's in the UAE today. Mm-hmm. Just give us, I don't know, your first impressions and what you think the long-term meaning of this trip is going to be and the reordering of relationships around the world and our foreign policy and our commerce, all of it. What did you think?
For sure. We'll take you straight to the Middle East. First, let me just lay out what we're going to talk about afterwards.
Okay.
Okay. So just a sneak preview. We'll talk about the Middle East. Then we'll dive into some of the legal issues in front of the Supreme Court, birthright citizenship, possibly the suspension of habeas corpus. We'll have a lot to say in our tipping point section about Jake Tapper and Joe Biden and original sin. And then we'll finish with our summary.
This is such a good episode.
It's really a great episode. Yeah, I think this trip is kind of vintage Trump, right? It's places, personalities he's comfortable with. It's clear that that's reciprocated. Remember, President Biden swore to make Saudi Arabia a pariah. He kind of backtracked on that, but they never really got over that. And Trump, he loved the chandeliers. He loves the gold. He loves the sort of regal trappings.
You have to stop there. We'll get to the serious stuff in a minute.
Yeah.
Did you not get the sense that President Trump was walking through these palaces and these private homes and thinking, why didn't I think of that? Right. I mean, this is opulence on a level that even he could not have imagined. It is that beautiful, actually. Yeah. Those chandeliers were something else.
Chandeliers were enormous.
The carpets, the mosque in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
It's a level of beauty and I don't know, like overt wealth that even President Donald Trump could not have imagined. And no American really understands. It's a distinctly Middle Eastern sort of thing.
It kind of makes me think of last week, Rebecca, we were talking about the beauty of the Vatican and sort of these like undemocratic spaces that are sort of for the few rather than the many. But because of that, they're able to be sort of extraordinarily beautiful.
Right. But the European versions of them are all from hundreds of years ago. They don't build them like that anymore. Right. The Middle East seems to be doing it today in its own way.
Yeah.
It's just sort of so interesting. But not really. Donald Trump looked, you know, when he walked into that emir's house and said, nice house.
Yeah.
He is just impressed.
Right. He said, as a construction guy myself, I admire
the white marble. Yeah. You can't get that white marble in America. Man, was he overwhelmed.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah. Clearly, there's a focus on commerce. There's a focus on deal making. I really thought that speech, I think it was in Riyadh, was a bellwether and a landmark of sort of this. There's a new regime. There's a new dispensation. The truth is, this had been a long time coming because this sort of nation building of the Bush years has sort of been out of fashion now for a long time. We had kind of the, you know, sort of Obama, Biden, let's call it multilateralism, whatever else we want to call it. But there was kind of a vacuum. And Trump very much announced that there's a new paradigm in place.
Right.
And that has to do with sort of, I'd say, a kind of live and let live, let's say, a renunciation of any desire to influence or change, you know, wealth at the center of it, I think that's its general shape.
Yeah, it did. It, you know, I went back and looked at Obama's speech in Cairo when he first went there. And a lot of the same themes actually come up about you do things your way, we do things our way. But the difference seemed to be that President Obama's speech was laced with that now old language of, you know, overcoming our differences and finding the points of commonality and sort of this merging sense of we're just like you, you're just like us, we're no better than you.
Yeah.
Trump was sort of delivering the same high level message, but that kind of language was clearly absent. He doesn't believe that. And it was all about prosperity and building wealth and building. Again, I always go back to this with him. He wants to build things, whether you like what he's building or not, but he's a builder.
Yeah.
And he doesn't need them to be like us. You know, he made fun of the sort of, I guess, the so-called limousine liberal types who've been flying over there in their jets and giving them lectures in the Middle East about how they should be. And I think what we've seen exposed through DOGE, a lot of the NGO activity about exporting the sort of contemporary American values, the ones that were present under the last administration over there, how that's been really the way that we've engaged with the rest of the world. And President Trump is saying, you know, no to not just transgender soap operas in the Middle East or Sesame Streets or whatever they did, but even in a broader scale to you have a culture and a society. It's my job to protect America, not to define your society. But we're going to get rich together.
Yeah. I mean, one thing is like these aren't real countries. I mean, not to be sort of insensitive about it, but they are autocracies with very small native populations.
Yes.
So they lend themselves to this kind of one-on-one deal making, right? You don't have to deal with like a street or popular opinion or any of that. I will say as it makes me a little bit nervous vis-a-vis the Israel front. One, not going. Two, and to give Trump credit, he did sort of insist is a strong word, but venture an opinion that he'd like Saudi Arabia to join the Abraham Accords. Mm-hmm. He did say in Qatar, you know, Hamas are a bunch of butchers and nothing's going to happen. And those are, you know, I applaud that. But I just worry in this sort of if our foreign policy is based on transactions and not values, Israel has much less to offer, right? Israel can't give a $1 trillion deal, right? That's not that, and I worry a little.
I think it was Nellie Bowles' line where she said it, something like, I'm paraphrasing, it turns out that these Middle Eastern Gulf states in particular have all the wealth that people accuse Jews of having.
Right, yeah.
Right? So that's what you're saying.
Yeah, and I just worry there if we move to a foreign policy that's sort of totally values neutral, and I'm not saying that's exactly where we're at, but, you know, what about those kinds of alliances
has been, right, have we really been pushing American values or haven't we? I mean, meaning we say, we give lip service to the idea that we're pushing democracy in the Middle East, but is that actually what we've done or have we not done that? And so...
Trump gets a real runway here because of the Abraham Accords. I mean, there's a certain track record here that has worked, and I get that, but... You know, Israel is a democracy that doesn't have the same ability to hand Trump wins, right? I mean, it just structurally. I mean, Netanyahu has his own political dynamics. I mean, that's what a democracy is, right? And a divided country. So, you know, I think Israel at the moment is a little bit on the outs here. And I'm not saying there's this huge rift. I'm not trying to overdramatize it, but I think Israel has to really think about how it makes itself worthwhile.
Yeah, there was that report of Netanyahu after a cabinet meeting saying to his cabinet ministers that, you know, Israel may have to pivot and find, you know, new alliances and things. And I don't think it was confirmed, but neither was it denied, which would suggest that he's worried or it's on his radar.
Yeah.
But we also never know what's happening behind the scenes and what the discussions are there.
Yeah.
And look, the Qatar thing is also, you know, just from the Qatar gate, you know, jet issue, all the optics of it, you know, President Trump didn't need that, I guess, but he clearly doesn't care. You know, and Steve Witkoff and his, you know, Park Lane sale to the Qataris and the Trump golf course that's going on.
I'm just going to say the Trumps make the Bidens look like they're selling pencils outside of Penn Station.
Right.
I mean, the money that is sloshing around in the Middle East and is wild.
It's wild.
It's wild.
But let's just also distinguish. They're doing it out in the open. They, in the sense that they don't feel they're doing anything illegal. It may look bad, but they're not hiding it from the American public. Whereas
I guess. But if the issue was trading on influence, trading on power, I mean, it's clear that that Trump sees the family sees its own material interests and American interests as converging.
I guess
indistinguishable.
I don't want to act. I'm not his defense attorney, Trump, but I do want to point out also that Big Pharma had given Trump $100 million during his campaign, and he hasn't exactly made them happy during his presidency. So it's possible to separate the two, but at least they're making these deals out in the open where we can see them and not hiding and pretending. And the Biden administration clearly did that. Yeah. But yes, the enormity of the wealth and Qatar has, I don't care how many times Donald Trump says that the Al Thanis are wonderful people and good friends.
Beautiful country.
I mean, they are sponsors of terror and disarray on the world. They're anti-American. They invade our institutions, our media, they're Al Jazeera. They're giving money to your alma mater. I mean, actors.
When Sinwar was killed or Haniyeh, they projected a huge picture. I mean, they're totally antithetical to American values. I will say just on the Israel front, I think one thing Israel that's clear here is Trump is, and I do think the administration is supportive of Israel broadly speaking, but I don't think there's going to be a huge interest in something like annexing the West Bank, or there's in a kind of dramatic ideological move. I think what's clear here is it's going to be evaluated on a very sort of like transactional basis. Right. And Trump wants quiet, and he wants quiet because I think the best version of the argument is when there's quiet, that's when deals can happen. You know, peace leads to a kind of prosperity.
And he sort of refloated this freedom zone, which is a new way of saying the old thing he was saying about Gaza, Mar-a-Lago combo. He wants quiet. He wants investment. He wants prosperity. And I think, can we not leave this segment without talking about when he came into the UAE? Did you see the women lining the way and shaking their long black hair as he walked through? And I just thought, this is the best TV ever. And actually, WhatsApped a friend of mine who lives in Dubai. And I said, what in the world am I looking at? Yeah. And he said, that's a traditional Emirati dance where you shake your hair. And I thought, they're mocking him because of his crazy hair. But no, it's actually part of their tradition and culture. But I just thought everything about the way this looked was, as if he had hired the best marketing team in the world and set it up. It just all made him look presidential and regal. And all of those countries lighting up their buildings in red, white, and blue, and the YMCA in the background, and all of it.
Yeah, the Gulf is not the Gulf might be a subtle place behind closed doors, but at least in public, right? And I think Trump got that, and that's a kind of a match between the kind of personalities.
Perfect match, made in heaven together.
Made in Mecca.
Anything else we want to say about the Middle East? Let's see, he's in the UAE now. We'll see what it yields.
Yeah.
Also the investments, right? The trillion, 2 trillion, was it, in investments? Yeah. We'll see what really happens and doesn't happen. But that was really the preload, the thing that they went there to announce that was decided well before. Yeah. And so that's the big announcement, that on the heels of lowering the executive order, Americans' pharmaceutical costs. It's all about the economy and reassuring Americans in the face of his tariffs that all this investment's pouring in and all these things are happening that will help them, even as the tariffs are ongoing. And I think he achieved that goal of reassuring the average American that the money spigot is on and good things are going to happen with the economy. It may or may not be true, but
the elephant in the tent is the Iran deal and what's happening there. And we don't really know there. But certainly, having Saudi Arabia close to America and, by extension, close to Israel is a crucial ally in whatever happens with Iran. I have some, Saudi friends, and, I'm under no illusion that it's, as I said, it's not a real country. I mean, it's a repressive regime. There's no putting, lipstick on a camel, but on the other hand, I do think that to deny the efforts that MBS has made at modernization is to stick your head in the sand, right? I mean, it really is remarkable.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the role of women, and I think that's that can only be helpful.
The women online are crushing on MBS, I have to say.
Yeah.
You may not have seen it, but I did.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just be careful, boys, girls.
That's good advice. Yeah. Okay. So we move on to Make It Make Sense. This is where I get to pick your brain on all these legal issues. But you wrote a really great piece in The Sun this past week about habeas corpus and the Trump potential challenge to it. Stephen Miller was cited as having suggested that maybe that's something that Trump can suspend.
Yeah.
The idea that individuals can contest their detention by the government. It's a constitutional right, but the questions remain about to whom does it apply and and when can it be invoked and when can it be taken away. So you want to frame out what the actual case is and then where we're going to go with that.
And, you know, one of the things that I've thought about Trump and the Constitution is that, you know, areas of the Constitution that have been kind of obscure and gathered dust for years, all of a sudden, you know, are now hot stuff and hot stories, whether it was the disqualification clause when he was running, whether it was presidential immunity. And now it's habeas corpus. I mean, habeas corpus is, you know, it's 1,000 years old. It dates back to England and King Henry II and then the Magna Carta, all that kind of boring stuff. But it is important because it allows for someone who's detained to challenge their detention. So it's a very kind of basic tool. And the idea is if you're in jail, you might not have a way to access the court. So it gives you the ability to say, I want to be taken to court and I want to make the case why I'm unlawfully jailed. It's limited. It can't be used all the time, but it's a pretty powerful tool. And the Constitution says that habeas corpus can only be suspended in a case of invasion, rebellion, or a case where public safety is threatened. So the first question you'd have to ask is, well, who can suspend it? There's no subject in the clause. And it seems to be that it can be suspended by a kind of combination of the president and Congress, because it's in the section of the Constitution that relates to Congress. The best example of the suspension of habeas corpus is Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. When he really did suspend it in a really robust way, following on a congressional action. But it's not
just in your article, you mentioned, I just wanted to ask about this. He suspended it for certain categories of people and then the entire state of Kentucky. So it can be applied to people or places or groups of people, anybody.
It gives the president enormous leeway to suspend it. So, it was also suspended by FDR during Pearl Harbor in Hawaii and by Teddy Roosevelt in the Philippines. So it's not kind of, I think some of the reaction was sort of, this is like the end of democracy kind of thing. And I also think Stephen Miller sets people off. But it's a real question. It's a real constitutional question. The argument for suspending it has historically been like, this is a time of crisis. We don't really have time to kind of, you know, to go through habeas as a sort of to give you the insight as someone who's a lawyer is anyone who deals with any kind of criminal defense or prosecution work knows that habeas petitions are like the bane of the court system. Everybody in prison files them all the time. And so it really is a way to sort of like muck up the works. And a lot of them are pretty frivolous, right?
Now, you also, I think, wrote that there was some decision in the 1990s maybe where, you know, the SCOTUS ruled that habeas corpus can be revoked for illegal immigrants at or around the border, but not in the interior. And so... help us. That's also a little bit vague. And is that still being, is that application still used today?
So, you know, immigration law is a big muddle. And basically what's emerged is that for some reason, and it might not sort of make logical sense, is that people who are apprehended at the border have fewer rights than people who've like made it into the interior. You might almost think
the border,
opposite.
Meaning before they've entered or maybe 5 miles in?
I don't know the exact, but it's sort of in the zone of the border or in the category of kind of being apprehended in the process of coming into the country. And so, you know, if people can kind of make it into the country, they kind of have a stronger legal status, not yet that of citizens, but still. One of the key precedents here is goes back to the war on terror. And this was in 2008, I believe. And in Boumediene, a 5-4 court, bitterly divided, would come out differently today, I'd say, decided that prisoners at Guantanamo Bay had the right to apply for habeas. So the issue here, just to kind of circle back, would be, one, would you need Congress?
Wait,
to
pass did they? And did they get it?
Yeah, so they had the right. Now, it doesn't mean that it's granted, but it meant that they could access habeas corpus.
And do we know what happened? Did many of them apply for it, and were they granted?
I think everybody would have applied. I don't know off the top of my head. You know, some of the people are still in Guantanamo, and it's a very, very complicated legal chapter. But anyway, so the question is, one, would Congress pass a law to suspend habeas corpus? Seems difficult given how tight Congress is. Two, could Trump do it if they don't? And three, would the current situation meet the criteria of an invasion?
Right. And one federal judge said it hasn't.
Yeah.
But
it's not clear. You know, well, what kind of scrutiny is that claim treated with, right? I mean, President Trump has declared an invasion in relation to the Alien Enemies Act, mm-hmm. which also requires such a declaration. A judge here in New York, Alan Hellerstein, says, well, you can't just say it's an invasion. In a way, Trump almost might be hurt by his own success at the southern border, right? I mean, if the numbers of illegal immigrants have basically dropped to zero, it makes it much harder to argue that
it's an
invasion.
Well, but those who are here might have been participating in an invasion that was allowed under the
Right. These would be the kind of questions a court would kind of have to sort
through. And who
through.
Gets to declare that it is or is not an invasion? That's not the president's right to make that declaration?
That's a real question. I mean, you know, I think that the hardest thing for the government's lawyers to get on top of, and apparently they've already solicited briefing on this from the Department of Justice and others, which suggests it's a serious issue, is, you know, the suspension of habeas corpus is in the section relating to the powers of Congress rather than the powers of the president. So it would seem, again, that Congress would have some role. Now, what role that would be, you know, that kind of has to be figured out.
And so if the president loses mm-hmm. in this case and he cannot suspend habeas corpus for all the illegal immigrants that are here, then what's the practical implication? That they still, anyway, they'd have to have an immigration judge hold a quick hearing, but they're not entitled to all trial.
Right.
That's limited to citizens of the country. So it's just that you'd have to go through one by one and have all of these immigration judges meet with them.
Yeah. But remember, you know, the Supreme Court held that all efforts to deport people under the Alien Enemies Act should go through habeas. So if you suspend habeas, it might be that those deportations are able to be fast-tracked. Right. Like right
without
now,
the immigration trial, without the immigration
still need some kind of process, but mm-hmm. the specific habeas track would be closed off.
Right.
Right.
He could take a few immigration judges and put them on the Qatari jet and just fuel it up.
You could put 500 immigration.
Right. And just go.
Yeah. Yeah. Land in El Salvador. It's probably bigger than the whole country.
Right.
But I mean, you know, I think with all these issues, remember, the president has a lot of discretion in terms of immigration and deportation. So, you know, part of it is that Trump is picking fights that are pretty difficult. I mean, whether it's the Alien Enemies Act or habeas, these are kind of obscure areas of law. So if he, you know, he can always default to sort of more traditional deportation. Remember, I mean, even Obama and Biden deported millions and millions of people.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe he's not trying to win the case. He's trying to get a bunch of politicians in New Jersey to, you know, body slam ICE agents and cause a big stink in media. And that's the intention. But, okay, so I'm just trying to understand then whether he wins or loses this habeas corpus case.
Well, just to be clear, there's no case yet. So say the government declares a suspension to habeas.
And then it's contested.
And it's contested,
If we get there, whichever way it pans out, though, it seems like each individual illegal immigrant would have to still have a hearing with an immigration judge either way.
Mm-hmm.
So what difference does it actually make for the purposes of deporting illegal immigrants? Mm-hmm. I don't see the difference.
Yeah. So the Supreme Court has said that you have to have the sort of some kind of process. It's not clear what kind of process it is. I mean, most people would say it's like, okay, you have to have a right to make your case in some form, right? And maybe present some evidence, you know, but like I said, habeas is a headache. And so if the government doesn't have to deal with habeas petitions, I mean, that's a real, you know, one less hurdle for them to deal with. We don't really know sort of what this process is going to look like. But like I said, like, you know, habeas petitions tend to flood the system. They require a response. You know, it's sort of another, you know, think of you're in a car and you're like facing a speed bump every 2 minutes, you know, if you take out half of them, you're going to go faster.
Right. Yeah. Okay, well, that would have led us into the birthright conversation, yeah. But I think we have to go on.
Well, maybe just quickly, just to kind of set up, just because the arguments were happening this morning, yes. And of course, you know, you guys might all be listening to this in the coming days, but you know what Trump did, interestingly, and his legal team here was not challenge the merits of birthright citizenship. He wants to get rid of it, meaning if a child is born to an illegal immigrant, they wouldn't, or even a temporary resident, they wouldn't necessarily be a citizen. But he wanted to go after the method of nationwide injunctions, right? So that's where one federal judge can say, I think this executive order is illegal and it's blocked across the country. My read, early read, hot take, first take is that the justices were skeptical of that, right? Because, you know, the court doesn't really like this like huge wholesale change. So maybe they'll say in certain circumstances, yeah, nationwide injunction doesn't make sense. But in immigration, it kind of does, right? So imagine you're a child of an illegal immigrant, and in New York, you know, you're considered a citizen, and in another state, you're not, right? I mean, this is one of those situations where, you know, we kind of want a standard across different states.
Right? Okay. And then would there be, just quickly, if that specific case about birthright citizenship doesn't lend itself neatly to the Supreme Court ruling on national injunctions by federal judges, is there another kind of case that you think could set that up more neatly? Because it feels to me, from what I'm reading, that this is really a pretty much a bipartisan issue, not having to do with President Trump, of course, but generally as a principle, people don't like federal judges issuing these rules for the entire country. Yeah. So what other kind of case would fit more neatly into that box and ticket for us?
Yeah. I mean, and you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, people on both sides of the aisle and have been super frustrated, you know. So for every Second Circuit liberal decision that infuriates Trump, there was a Fifth Circuit conservative decision that drove Biden crazy. So no question. Also, nationwide injunctions only really came about in the 1960s. So it's not like we've always had this with us. In fact, they're not at all known to the common law. Like they're not, because a basic of the legal system is a judge makes a decision about the parties before him,
right?
That it's, you can't make a decision, at least you shouldn't, that binds, you know, all of us,
yes.
Right? It's sort of like if we're the litigants in a case and we're before a judge, it would be kind of unfair if our producer, Victor, you know, has to live with that decision. Yeah. Now, sometimes that's inevitable, right? Any decision is going to affect more people than just the people before you. But as much as possible, you know, try to avoid that. I mean, one thing that could be done is Congress could limit, could ban the use of universal injunctions. But then again, this is one issue almost where it's like bipartisanship kind of makes it almost harder to, because, you know, sometimes one side wants them.
Maybe they'll do it the day before Trump leaves office, but they're not going to do it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right, let's go on to our tipping point. Yeah. And this is to do with the so-called revelations about President Biden's mental acuity or, you know, lack thereof during his term as president, and Jay Tapper's book, which came out called Original Sin, in which he, you know, is talking to all the people who are now blowing the whistle on this issue. I think the first thing that I just have to say is, of course, since it's been said, is that Jake Tapper himself was sort of on an interview mocking Laura Trump for, you know, making fun of the president's stutter and shaming her for that and pretending that he wasn't, you know, mentally impaired. So, I mean, the whole idea of the book, I don't even want to talk about that so much because it's so opportunistic and silly. And I think everyone sees through that. And
Number one New York bestseller.
Right. Well, you know, there's always a market for people who want to believe that kind of thing. But I think the bigger point for me was, you know, we alluded to this in our interview with Peter Schweitzer last week about how we often sort of we can point to institutions or entities that behave badly, and we never kind of, you know, attach names of the people responsible. Mm-hmm. And that felt like what was happening here, other than with the media. The media names are being dropped and those people are being thrown under the bus, usually by other people who committed the same offense. But when it comes to the government, there's always, this is just this word, the administration didn't tell us. The administration, well, who is that? And I have some names, right? She's not part of the administration. Dr. Jill Biden has been on my blacklist since day one because it was very obvious from day one of his presidency that he was mentally impaired in some way. I don't care what people say the doctor said or if it got worse as his term went on. Anybody with eyes could see the problems from day one. She, of course, knew better than anybody because she lived with him. And a lot of people who are married, I will just tell you this as a fact. If you're married for a long time, the instinct to homicide is almost a daily occurrence. But what you don't have is the instinct to humiliate your partner in public ever. And people who are willing to do that hate their spouses. You could kill them before you would see them publicly humiliate themselves. And she allowed that to happen every day. And I don't know her personally. This is just my view of it. She knew, she knows, she allowed this to happen more than anybody else in his circle, and shame on her. And she should be named for it. This is her responsibility. And then names, right? Like Antony Blinken or Lloyd Austin or Jake Sullivan or Kamala Harris, who also knew. It's not the administration
Ron
that
Klain,
lied.
Mike Donilon. You know,
right. The list goes on. Yeah. It wasn't the administration that lied to the American people. It was people who lied to the American people, and they should be held to account. And I don't like this language that we're using around this because it absolves people or it lets them skirt the issue. Mm-hmm. They knew. They all knew. And then just the last point is Americans knew. The ones who are buying this book now, Jake Tapper's book, and the ones who would never buy it, we all knew. We all saw it. And we don't need some doctor or physician to sign off on a document. We didn't need Jill Biden or Jake Tapper or anybody else to tell us. It was clear as day. And there's something wrong in us, in all of us, that we don't just stand up and say what we know to be true because either we have political interests or financial interests, or we're just afraid to be mocked. I think COVID taught us not to do that anymore, and we have to stop doing it.
Yeah. No, well said. George Orwell said, seeing what's in front of your nose is a constant struggle. And this was an example of that. It's surreal looking back. I still think it's worthwhile to have books like this to document. I think, I'm sort of less persuaded by this sort of, obviously there's hypocrisy, obviously better late than never is a sort of a weak thing, but I still think we need reporting on this. I mean, this was a major issue. It changed American history. It was a human story, as you said. It was a political story. It was a story of power and its corruptions. It was a story of illusion versus reality. So, I'm sort of really interested in this. I think it'll be spoken of in the same way as other cover-ups throughout history.
But the annoying part is we had reporting on it, just not by the media that supported Joe Biden. So this isn't even reporting. This is just some way to cover up their cover up.
Yeah. I mean more like, how was this done? To your point, who were the people in the room? Yeah. Who were the people who covered or how did they do it? I think it also helps us understand the sort of institution of the presidency and how it's possible that the most visible person in the world, can be sort of, protected that way. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but I'm thinking of, no one knew FDR was in a wheelchair. I mean, we always used to say, oh, that could never happen nowadays, right? Because of the media, it sort of did, right? Almost literally, as we've learned from the book.
Well, maybe people didn't know because they didn't have TV, so maybe you could get away with it to some degree. But here, what's shocking to me is that everybody knew. I don't care who's denying it now. Literally no one who has a functioning brain cell didn't know that that man was impaired. And so we all participated in mass delusion for our own purposes.
And what was extraordinary, as the case with most scandal, is like the real brunt of it is being felt by his political party. I mean, that's the sort of extraordinary thing, is that the kind of consequences were a sort of political catastrophe for the Democrats of the first order. And this is where we almost get to a kind of Shakespearean tragedy, right? Or a Greek tragedy, where hubris is the thing that undoes you, right? And it's the irony is never about like some third party gets hurt. The irony is that you are complicit in your own destruction.
Okay, but just say something about accountability from a legal point of view now. In the voting booth, they're going to suffer. They have suffered, and they should. They should suffer more, actually, for this. This is unbelievable what happened. Yeah. But
Also, just unbelievable because there were so many off-ramps. I mean, you know, Biden could have not run again. You know, you mentioned maybe he was too old to run in the first place. He could have dropped out, but had a room for, I mean, it was so, one person told Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson, his co-author, you know, this was an abomination.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. So just a quick question. What is there any legal case to be made against an administration official who knew that the president was not compos mentis and didn't say anything? Is that against the law?
I don't know. I think that's a tough case. I mean, I think, you know, we live in an era of, unfortunately, blind partisan lockstep, you know, sort of messaging. And the problem was that nobody felt comfortable calling it out, you know.
But there's no actual obligation to report if the president of the United States is not capable of doing his job. You have no obligation to say.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, one of the interesting things is there weren't really whistleblowers, right? There really weren't. You know, people after, once the dam broke, people were willing to speak up. And just think of, on the contrary, how many whistleblowers you had against Israel in the first Biden administration around the Israel policy.
Yes.
It was like a sieve from State Department.
And by the way, not only did they not blow the whistle on his mental status, but they actively did things to help cover it up. It wasn't just, I don't see anything, I don't know anything. Actually, writing out the cue cards, the teleprompters, the, you know, putting a lid on him at 12 p.m., the medications that he was clearly taking that someone was administering, those are active attempts to mask this from the public. Mm-hmm. So there's some, you know, actual activity taking place to participate in the cover-up beyond just stepping.
I think one thing that I think you're absolutely right to say that there should be accountability. I mean, I think the accountability is, as you said, it's among the people in his inner circle who are still in denial, honestly. And then the people who like never saw him, but who should have, right? So there was, you know, reports that there wasn't a cabinet meeting in like years. And like the cabinet meetings are dumb. I mean, Trump's are like rallies. But still, like if you're the Secretary of State, you know, at some point, you know, are you speaking to the president? Are you, you know?
Anthony Blinken has a television like I do.
Yeah.
He saw what I saw.
Yep. Yep.
Let's do our sunburns.
Go ahead.
That felt like one. My sunburn is the journalist Glenn Greenwald, who I actually listen to almost daily and who I like on so many issues, things like free speech, for instance, he is extraordinarily good on. But he had this quote, I'm just going to read, he posted this to X, the day that the American-Israeli hostage Idan Alexander was released. And he posted it in response to a picture in the Jerusalem Post of hundreds of people celebrating in Idan Alexander's New Jersey hometown when he was released with their flags. And this is what Glenn Greenwald wrote. Seeing lots and lots of national flags being waved at this event in New Jersey, celebrating the return of the Israeli-American IDF soldier Idan Alexander. But vanishingly few of those flags are the American flag. I have often felt about Mr. Greenwald that when he was 7 years old, some Hasidic rabbi with an Israeli accent walked up to him on the street of, I'm going to say Brooklyn, I don't know where he grew up, kicked him in the shin and stole his bicycle. Yeah. So deeply visceral is his anger and animosity towards anything that has the word Israel in it, it seems to me. And very different from the way he treats every other subject, even topics with which he really takes issue. He seems to reserve a special anger in his bones about anything having to do with Israel, such that even the celebration of a 21-year-old kid
who was
released from 580-something days in terrible captivity in a tunnel and being tortured, he couldn't let it go for a day, and suggesting that because these people were holding some Israeli flags, and there aren't a million Israeli flags, but most of the ones that you do see are Israeli flags, somehow suggests that this kid may have gotten what he deserved, or because he fought for some foreign country, as he calls it, a foreign country in his further thread, that therefore, you know, and that celebrating it is some allegiance to a foreign nation and not to America. And I'm going to sunburn myself because I made the novice mistake of commenting on X, which I really almost never do because I was so shocked at the bad behavior.
Yeah.
And I think I just wrote something like, don't do that today.
Yeah.
The kid just got released. And the comments, Mr. Greenwald, as far as I could tell, as of this morning, hadn't responded, but his followers did. And I I fell into the trap, of course, but the nasty, vile, you know, he was a soldier, so he deserved it, or whatever they were saying. It taught me the lesson: sunburn on me. Don't reply to threads on X, and don't expect people to show their best face on X. I think Greenwald's best work is definitely on his show and in his Substack, but not on X. Yeah. But you know, to Mr. Greenwald, just whoever, on behalf of the rabbi who kicked you in the shin, the Jewish people apologize, but you know, cut it out. Yeah. And Idan Alexander deserves to come home with compassion and dignity and respect.
Yeah. And you know, just to kind of piggyback on that, Rebecca, it's almost exactly wrong, because in oftentimes in sort of, you know, pro-Israel spaces, or you see tons of American flags. Where you don't see American flags is in pro-Palestinian rallies.
Write that. Write that to him.
You see them burned, you know.
So I should have thought of that, right?
That's I didn't do a forensic analysis of the crowd, but I'd imagine that at any sort of space. And it's just, you know, it's this kind of horseshoe thing. I mean, you know, it's just there's a real ugliness out
and
there.
And at pro-Palestinian rallies, of course, there are many Palestinian flags.
Yeah, of course.
And I don't remember his objecting to that.
Right, exactly. Okay, my sunburn is going to be about Qatar Force One. I think, you know, there's a clause in the Constitution called the Emoluments Clause, where presidents are not supposed to accept a gift or a bribe unless Congress authorizes it. Congress may authorize it. Honestly, I wouldn't be shocked if this somehow is withdrawn or allowed to fade away. It's so egregious, even from folks on the right and from within Trump's coalition have sort of really denounced it. I mean, it'd be one thing to accept a plane from Qatar if it then is donated to the presidency, but to then keep it after your president for your private use is just a kind of excess that I think is, you know, reinforce my sensibility that Trump is most popular when he's most constrained, and that Trump really left to his own devices is sometimes his own worst enemy. So I think, you know, there's a lot to like about the trip. Not everything, as we talked about, but this was really, I think a bridge too far.
He needs to donate it to El Salvador. That would just be the funniest thing ever. And
direct flight.
Everybody would be happy
about just
that.
Fly people around the world. Yeah. Anyway, Rebecca, always fun. We'll see you next week. Bye.